Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is Dispatches. U.S. officials and their corporate media mouthpieces were elated at the sight of protests in Cuba in recent days against deteriorating living conditions in the middle of a pandemic amidst U.S. economic strangulation of the tiny island nation. As is often the case when an adversary country experiences protests of any kind, it was immediately weaponized to push for a regime change narrative against Cuba. There's so much to unpack here, from the protest double standards to the blatant efforts at meddling and sabotage to the pure hypocrisy from those in power in the U.S. To help us make sense of it all, I'm joined by Manolo de los Santos, founder and co-director of the People's Forum in New York City and a researcher with Tricontinental who also happened to live in Cuba for 6 years. Manolo, welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here, Rania.
Now, before we get started, I just want to remind those who are watching to click the subscribe button. And for those who are listening, you can watch any episode of Rania Kallik Dispatches on the Breakthrough News YouTube page. And for those who are watching, you can listen to all of these episodes in podcast form. Anywhere you get podcasts, just look up Rania Kallik Dispatches. So, to the topic at hand. Manolo, I have to say, it's impressive how many countries the U.S. is capable of strangling simultaneously, causing these food and medicine shortages and stifling access to fuel. I'm sitting in one of those countries right now in Lebanon. And then Western media will come along and blame all this misery and death on bad governance, or in the case of Cuba, on socialism. And sometimes people believe it. You know, President Joe Biden, he made this statement where he said, "We stand with the Cuban people in their clarion call for freedom." And he called on the Cuban regime to hear their people and serve their needs at this vital moment rather than enriching themselves. And then, of course, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki attributed the protests to a lack of access to health supplies and vaccines. The New York Times went on and said people are protesting due to, quote, power outages, food shortages, and a lack of medicine, without giving any context to what's causing these shortages. And then I just want to note that the Cuban president himself did respond to these claims, saying, and I quote, "The protests involve many revolutionary citizens who want an explanation for the current situation in the country, but are also contaminated by groups of opportunists who take advantage of the current crisis to undermine order and generate chaos." So all that said, let's start, Manolo, by talking about who was protesting and why, and then we can go from there.
Well, thank you for introducing it in that way, because I think that the most important thing to realize here, this is the first, you can't start any of this conversation without talking about the U.S. blockade. The fact that for 60 years, the U.S. government has intentionally harmed and driven the Cuban people to starvation has to be the starting point for any conversation on what's happening in Cuba. The reality is that, you know, add to the 60 years of blockade, you add a pandemic, which has essentially finished destroying Cuba's economy. It has dried up Cuba's sources of revenue. The tourism industry, which many of the people, millions of people in Cuba depend on as a source of income, has, you know, vanished in the past year due to the COVID-19. And Cuba's had to basically rely on resources that it doesn't have to keep the nation going. So, understandably, especially in the summer heat, with severe electrical outages, with lack of food, lack of medicine, of course, there are legitimate reasons for people to go out to the streets. And the president was right. I mean, many people who went out to protest on Sunday are people who actually, many of them support the revolution. Many believe in the socialist project. Many have fought for the socialist project. In Cuba, many have done internationalist missions abroad to defend the socialist project. But the situation is grave. It is severe. And the reality is that the majority of those people were responding to a social and economic crisis, not a political one. They are those few opportunists, I would say very clearly, many of them paid by the U.S. government, whose sole mission is to provoke actual political crisis where there is none. This is not a sign of a break in the faith of the revolution. There is no sort of break between the revolution and the people. There's just, this is the reality of living under a blockade, a severe blockade, which, you know, I think sometimes folks talk about the blockade, but don't understand that it really cuts at every aspect of your life from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed. And even then, the blockade never ceases to exist in your life.
Exactly. And I think, of course, that's the elephant in the room, right? When you get all these statements from U.S. officials talking about, you know, Cubans don't have access to vital goods, it's you're the reason why. And, you know, it came at an interesting time because it was just, I think, a couple weeks ago that the U.N. General Assembly had its yearly vote on ending the embargo on Cuba that's been in place for 60 years. And the only no votes came from the U.S. and Israel.
Of course.
And it's even worse now because, you know, while Obama had started to reduce some of those restrictions on Cuba, Trump reimposed them and even went further by placing restrictions on remittances, which people in Cuba depend on. And we know for a fact that this embargo is meant to destroy the country. I mean, if you go back and look at State Department records from the 60s, they explicitly state that the goal of the U.S. government's blockade on Cuba is to weaken the economic life of Cuba. I'm reading from a State Department memo about this, to weaken the economic life of Cuba and, quote, decrease monetary and real wages to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow the government. So I want to get a little bit more into what this embargo has meant for Cuba, particularly at a time when there's a global pandemic that has already hurt so many economies that don't have to deal with this extra issue of blockade. So what is this embargo, what does this blockade mean for average Cubans?
Well, the first thing is that I refuse to use the word embargo because the word embargo situates itself within a certain lingo of international law that makes it seem lesser than of what it actually is. An embargo would imply only, you know, a limitation to certain facets of the economy or of society. I call it a blockade. The Cuban people call it a blockade precisely because it actually goes at everything. It goes at, you know, direct trade between the United States and Cuba. Cuba is not allowed to purchase anything directly with, you know, with currency, any currency directly to the United States. The few exceptions that are allowed require Cuba, you know, strangely enough, to pay in U.S. dollars, in cash, ahead of time, 2-3 months ahead of time in order to purchase frozen chicken from the United States. These are the weird exceptions that the U.S. blockade allows. The heavier weight of the U.S. blockade is on international trade. Many people say, well, why can't Cuba trade with the rest of the world? Well, even when it wants to, there are severe limitations. Many people don't know, for example, that any foreign ship that docks in Cuba cannot dock in the United States for over 6 months afterwards, which means that any ship, you know, a ship that comes from Lebanon, for example, its natural port after Cuba, the next port would be Florida or any port in the United States. It means transporting to Cuba becomes much more expensive, and companies have to think twice whether they ship to Cuba or not. There are elements of the blockade that say that if there are products produced in other countries but that have are either, you know, owned in shares partly by a U.S. company, that company cannot trade to Cuba. If Japan makes cars and part of the one piece of that car is produced in the United States, Japan cannot sell those cars to Cuba. And to add another element to the blockade, which is that actively, members of U.S. embassies abroad, officers of U.S. embassies actually go after trade deals that the Cubans make with other countries and tell them, you know, basically, we've seen this in many places like Mexico, for example, where they will tell a company, a medical, pharmaceutical, you know, what would you rather trade with? Would you rather just trade $500,000 with Cuba, or would you rather trade millions of dollars with the U.S.? You know? And many companies are essentially scared away from trading with Cuba. That has been the reality for the last 60 years. And for a period of that time, because the Soviet Union existed, because socialist countries around the world existed, a whole, you know, a powerful socialist camp existed, Cuba was able to lessen the impact of the blockade. But post 1991, Cuba essentially has been left on its own in a world where nobody wants to touch the sanctioned country. We know this for Lebanon. We know this for Iran. We know this for Zimbabwe. Once you're on that list, everyone sort of treats you with a, you know, 10-foot pole. And the reality is that, add to that right now the fact that Cuba's access to foreign currency, to hard currency, to U.S. dollars is severely limited. It means that even if it wanted to make deals, even if it could make deals, it just doesn't have the currency, the cash, the money to pay for it. That is the biggest roadblock right now.
And in the midst of a pandemic, I mean, what are the additional hardships that this has caused during COVID? I mean, I know that Cuba has had this shortage of syringes. It managed to develop these vaccines, which is incredible given the strangulation it's under. And we can talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But just in the middle of the COVID, one of the things that you keep hearing from U.S. officials is Cubans don't have access to vital health essentials and in the middle of a pandemic. But again, it's your fault. So I know there's this issue of syringes, and I know there's a medication shortage. There's also been power outages, right? Like, there's been power outages. And what I was reading was that there's a fuel shortage, and as a result, you know, they've had to divert as much fuel as possible to health clinics and hospitals because of the surge in COVID cases to deal with that. So people are left dealing with blackouts. And it just makes me think, you know, that's what Lebanon's dealing with right now. We have these blackouts. We have a fuel shortage. It's not entirely because of sanctions, but it's a part of it. With Syria, it's absolutely because of sanctions. With Iran, I was just in Iraq a week ago. Iraq isn't under sanction, but because Iran is under sanction, it's affecting Iraq's ability to generate power. So there was blackouts, no AC in the middle of 120 degree weather. So it just seems like this kind of Cuba blockade model is being imposed on adversary countries as the norm now. Like, it's not just Cuba anymore.
I mean, it's ultimately about the full spectrum dominance of the United States. Even when, you know, many of these countries fight for their sovereignty, are fighting for their independence, for their right to actually determine their own futures, the US's ultimate vengeance is, we will dominate you through pain and suffering. We will bring you to heal. We will make you kneel in front of the empire. And, you know, luckily for us, our countries have a great sense of resistance, a great capacity to actually build. And part of it is that, you know, in spite of this 60 years of blockade, Cuba may not have medicines right now, but Cuba has an excellent healthcare system, a national public healthcare system, which reaches every citizen and doesn't charge 1 cent for its services. In fact, it was important for the health minister yesterday in a press conference to say, you know, it's true. We are lacking all the medicines that we may need right now. In fact, we wish we had an investment that would allow us to actually buy many of the raw materials that would allow us to actually produce those medicines in Cuba. But that's not possible right now. But despite that, all the hospitals are open. Hospitals are running. Cuba has more doctors than it needs. And it, you know, distributes them equally across the country and sends them abroad as well. No citizen has gone without being treated. That's the important thing to mention, I think, that we don't want to also go deeply into this pity story or the misery of the people as the ultimate condition. We have to say that the people are fighting with a lot of dignity right now. Yes, there is no food in Cuba right now, but no one has gone hungry either. The country organizes itself essentially to make sure that the needs of all its people are being met. And that's remarkable. I mean, in fact, the story of the outages itself is a remarkable story because there are outages in the last month, essentially, but there hadn't been outages for over a year. Even though Cuba's consumption of fuel and oil was decreasing by the day, partly because the U.S., the modern-day pirates of the world, were stealing oil ships in the middle of the sea. They were stopping Iranian ships bringing oil to Cuba and Venezuela and stealing them and selling that oil for its own profit.
Amazing, amazing.
I mean, there's very few people. I think, Rania, you and many, a few others have been the only people to talk about this. The fact that we have modern day pirates on the sea called the United States government. That's a reality. So in spite of all these challenges, the fact that even with traditional oil trading partners that Cuba has, it hasn't been able to fulfill all its needs, but it hasn't actually had outages till just this month, which is when, again, Cuba was forced to put against the wall with not just the lack of fuel, but also a lack of spare parts to run the electric plants, to run the national electric grid. And even then, Cuba's essentially trying its best to not affect the civilian population, to even cut down on government use of electricity, to cut down on industrial use of electricity, to allow people to have access to electricity. That is, again, to me, the remarkable side of that story.
Yeah, and what's incredible about the people who are accusing the Cuban officials of enriching themselves, despite what you just explained, are the same people who live in mansions and are millionaires in the U.S. who are literally doing, it's like pure projection. They're actually doing exactly what they're accusing their adversaries of doing. That said, you know, I do want to get into the resiliency of the Cuban system, because obviously this isn't the first time that Cuba has had to deal with this. It's been dealing with this nonstop for 60 years. But first, you know, I do want to address the fact that there were people, I'm not going to name names or anything, but, you know, some activists and journalists in the progressive sphere who were mocking anyone that blamed the protest on the U.S. or U.S. meddling or the CIA. And, you know, perhaps that is a very simplistic narrative to just say anyone protesting is just a CIA agent. However, you know, this also ignores the historical record, right, of relentless U.S. meddling in Cuba. I mean, I think Cuba might be the most attacked country in the world by the CIA. And that includes over 500 assassination attempts. That includes a CIA attempt. This one really gets me. There was a CIA attempt to bribe Raul Castro's pilot into causing an accident in which the CIA promised the pilot that if he died, they would ensure his two sons received a full college education. And what I find funny on top of disturbing about this is that you don't need to bribe Cubans with a full college education for free because they already get that. But you know, the CIA has also trained terrorists who blew up Cuban civilian airliners, who've bombed Cuban hotels to try to destroy the tourism industry. I mean, and on and on and on. And some of these U.S.-backed fascists, of course, are living in Miami till this day, where, you know, they are safe from prosecution for their crimes. You know, I could sit here all day and just list off the ways that the U.S. has tried to destroy Cuba, but we'd be here for hours, so I won't do that. But, you know, on top of that, there's all this money that the U.S. spends on these destabilization programs that they call democracy programs. I mean, even now, the House Appropriations Committee has recently approved another $20 million for so-called Cuba democracy programs, which of course doesn't actually go to promoting democracy, but quite the opposite. But I guess that's just to say, you know, I kind of did just give an overview of how the U.S. has tried to destabilize Cuba for 60 years and why, but how do you respond to that claim that we do see more of you can't just always blame the U.S. when it comes to Cuba?
Well, I love to think that intellectuals and journalists in the U.S. are the kings of and queens of nuance. they feel they own the concept of nuance. And they are the most nuanced people on the planet. They are the most objective people on the planet as well, because they sit in the seat of power in the United States. But I think the real nuance analysis is coming out of Cuba itself. Mm. I mean, the leaders of the party, of the Communist Party of Cuba, leaders of the government, both the president and different ministers, have been actually very, very sharp in their analysis. Mm. They haven't said everyone who went out to protest is a CIA agent. They haven't said everyone who went to protest went for the wrong reasons. No, on the contrary, they're saying a majority of the people who went out to protest went out for real reasons. And they went asking for answers. And they went, you know, dissatisfied. Nobody is denying the fact that there are dissatisfied people in Cuba. In fact, the Cuban government constantly affirms it has a better understanding of dissatisfaction in Cuba than the CIA ever does with all its agents on the island. So if anyone has a good understanding of what's happening on the ground is the Cuban government and the Cuban Communist Party, in part because they have such a tight relationship with the people. This is in a sense, didn't surprise the Cuban government. They know the situation was hard. They know the situation was going to get harder, and it's going to get harder for the Cuban people. And they're doing the best to deal with it. But we cannot underscore the fact that there are CIA agents in Cuba. Mm-hmm. That there are actual programs funded by the U.S. government, some of them public, many of them not public, that engage in acts of subversion in Cuba. And when I say acts of subversion, I'm not talking about people who just print out a pamphlet and go hand it out. Yes, there are people who do that who don't need to be paid by the U.S. government. But there are actively people who are paid in Cuba to destroy the collective property of the Cuban people, who actively go out to attack schools, who attack farms, to destroy food, to destroy medicines. There are people who actively do that. And they're sadly for the US, but good for the Cuban people. Yes, they are arrested and they are repressed in Cuba. You know? Right. But, you know, I would say that another characteristic moment of the Cuban process is that there are all these protests yesterday. The majority of people were not arrested for protesting, because they were working people, people of our class, workers, peasants, people who, again, legitimately were dissatisfied, are dissatisfied, and they have a right to do so. And they have a right to protest in Cuba. The Cuban Constitution doesn't deny their right to protest, contrary to popular belief.
Despite what Ted Cruz may believe, yeah.
Despite what Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Joe Biden seem to think. On the contrary. In fact, the Cuban police went out to, in a sense, make sure that their right to protest never went in a violent direction. Mm. But there was no Cuban police or military even on the street who went out to repress the protests. In fact, the only people who were arrested were the people who were visibly attacking stores, looting, and which is funny, the looting that happened.
It's normal.
Again?
Which is normal to arrest people. I mean, it's normal to arrest people for that. But,
you know, in a situation of crisis, it's funny that the looting that happened was not of food. The people who looted high price, you know, electrical, you know, fridges and TVs. nobody stole food. So, you know, in all of this, I think we have to pay attention to the fact that Cuba is not what the U.S. intellectual elites want to paint. It's right. Not paradise, but it's not a repressive hell that they want to paint it either. You know, it's not any perfect place. It has many contradictions. You know, the fact that the president immediately went out to one of these protests to walk and talk with the people. I mean, we saw when Trump wanted his photo op last year with Black Lives Matter, in the middle of the Black Lives Matter protests. He wanted a photo in front of a church. How many thousands of people got pepper sprayed and attacked and arrested for that? In Cuba, nobody got arrested so that the president can talk to the people.
And the president can actually, yeah, go and talk to the people. And then on top of that, of course, I'm glad that you mentioned that the reality of Cuba isn't what the intellectual and political class make it out to be in the U.S., because a lot of what we see ends up what we see on social media. And there's, I just want to remind everyone, you know, there's so much manipulation on social media. I mean, we know that the U.S. has tried to, you know, create fake Twitter in Cuba. It was a huge failure, but it was meant to, you know, try to promote these kind of like flash mob protests, and it didn't end up working and it got shut down. But the social media manipulation also happens to us in the U.S. I don't know if you experienced this as these protests were happening, but just like, you know, say anything that challenges the mainstream narrative and you're inundated with just like hundreds of bot accounts that just started January 2021 and they've never tweeted before until now. And they're all tweeting the same exact thing, SOS Cuba. So people should definitely be skeptical of that. But I want to talk a little bit, you know, I want to move on from these protests in particular and talk a little bit about Cuba before and after the revolution. You know, and I think for like a lot of people, it seems like this is something everyone should already know, but especially with, you know, younger people learning about leftism and leftist countries, and maybe who don't know so much about Cuba, you know, when these exiles and these regime changers and these capitalists talk about suppression of freedom after the Cuban Revolution, I always laugh because, you know, what freedoms were taken away? Cuba was a U.S.-backed dictatorship that executed people. It was like a slave state
before the revolution. You're forgetting that it was a wonderful place for the powerful Cuba.
Exactly. It was a wonderful place for the powerful, and masses of people lived in poverty and were illiterate and didn't have access to health clinics and basic services, didn't have access to education. And, you know, a lot of the people that we, the Cubans, of course, that we see in Miami and other parts of the U.S., not all of them, but a lot of them are the descendants of these families, that these rich, wealthy families whose land was redistributed, who literally had like plantations and factories where their workers were essentially like slave labor. But I want to talk a little bit about what the revolution accomplished. Like, because there is something in Cuba that is worth protecting, despite all of its contradictions, and it's not a paradise and a perfect place. Can you talk a little bit about what Cuba has accomplished for those who maybe aren't as aware?
Well, I think this is actually an important story to tell. And I'm glad you raised this question, because it actually helps to explain why the revolution hasn't been able to overthrow. Mm-hmm. Why is it that despite millions of dollars, the U.S. government, the CIA, its intelligence agencies have not been able to unravel the Cuban revolution, even today, even right now? And partly is because the Cuban people themselves became active participants in building a revolution. It wasn't Soviet tanks that arrived in Havana and freed the Cuban people. The Cuban people freed themselves. They created their process of liberation with many mistakes, with many contradictions, but they did it themselves. They went from a country where healthcare was a privilege and where many children died of simple ailments like diarrhea, would simply die, where hunger was a reality, where having the opportunity to go to school, not talking university, I'm talking to go past the fifth grade, was a dream, if not an illusion, for the majority of children on the island. Went from that to actually being a country that guarantees healthcare, that there are, you know, the ratio of doctors to patients in Cuba is higher than in the majority of places around the world, including the United States. The fact that Cuba produces more doctors per capita than many places around the world is a result of the revolutionary process. The fact that Cubans now have eradicated many basic diseases that still continue to ravage countries in Africa, Latin America, and Asia is a remarkable feat. The fact that the Cuban people have guaranteed education up to the highest levels. I mean, I have friends my age. I don't have a master's degree. My friends have PhDs, multiple PhDs, for which they never paid a cent. All not courtesy of the revolution, courtesy of the work of the people of Cuba. The Cuban people have sacrificed a lot for these gains. The fact that housing is a right, the fact that no one is ever kicked out of their homes in Cuba. That is a remarkable change from what it used to be before 1959. And yes, there are difficulties with food now, but the reality is that now, despite all the challenges, Cuba has organized itself to make sure that everyone has access to food. You know, this idea that some people are enriching themselves or making themselves rich is a joke. If anyone who's been to Cuba knows Cuba, has even looked at what officials in Cuba look like, would know that these are not people who make any money, who get any resources from stealing from the people. On the contrary, I would say ultimately the biggest change that's happened since 1959 is that the Cuban people have dignity now. And dignity is hard to put in a box. It's hard to describe even sometimes. But it's the fact that the Cuban people can stand up every morning and say happily that they're an independent country. That in the middle of a pandemic, they could produce 5 vaccines with their own resources, which are limited and difficult to find. What other country can say this? What other country can say that we send doctors to the people of the world? In Cuba, there's no bigger pride for a family to say, oh, my son or daughter was a doctor who served in Pakistan, or they served in Venezuela, or they served in Angola, or in Ethiopia. That's the biggest pride a family has. That's real dignity. And if only many other countries around the world could have that dignity to stand up to the world and say, we are free people.
I mean, when you're saying that's something that brings so much pride. There's nothing that can bring more pride to a family than having somebody serving as a doctor. I'm just thinking how in the U.S. nothing brings more pride than having someone who serves in the military. I mean, it's like the polar opposite. It really is. It's such a polar opposite from capitalism to socialism. I mean, you know what Cuba doesn't have? It doesn't have, I think someone said Cuba doesn't have GoFundMe campaigns to try to fund, you know, cancer treatment. We have that. You know, they don't have tent cities full of homeless people. I don't think people realize housing is a human right. It's a right in Cuba. They don't have homeless people. We have literally tent cities in America of homeless people. The contrast, it couldn't be more stark. But you mentioned the doctors. Can you talk a little bit about the medical brigades? Because I do think this is such an amazing accomplishment that Cuba has played such a vital role all around the world in helping to combat disease, in helping to combat combat epidemics like the Ebola epidemic. You know, the U.S. pats itself on the back for sending its military. I'm not quite sure why it had to send its military to Africa to help with the Ebola problem, but Cuba actually sent doctors. Can you talk a little bit about the medical brigades that the U.S. is constantly demonizing as some sort of evil propaganda campaign? What are the medical brigades? What's the purpose? And why does Cuba do this?
Well, you know, I always think it's very, not just insulting, but quite racist the way the U.S. describes these medical brigades. To call free black people slaves in the 21st century should be completely called out as a racist slur. Mm. The fact that these are mostly people of color who have worked hard to attain their medical degrees and who voluntarily go join these medical brigades, to be called slaves is not just insulting, but incredibly racist. The fact is that Cuba, since the beginning of the revolution, actually going back to 1962, 1963, Cuba at that moment had less than 3,000 doctors. And they decided to send a brigade of hundreds of doctors and nurses to Algeria, which had just won its independence and had no doctors. You know, that's the spirit of Cuba's medical, what people call medical diplomacy, but that for the Cuban people, it's simply solidarity. Their act of being in solidarity with other countries and other peoples. And motivated by, one, going to the places that are in most need and not asking for anything in return. Sometimes at great cost to the Cuban people themselves. Because many times these are brigades where the doctors are bringing medicine from Cuba to treat patients abroad. And we've seen these brigades go to the Himalayas when there was an earthquake in Pakistan. Among the first doctors to arrive and the last to leave were the Cuban doctors who arrived in the mountainous regions of Pakistan, learned Urdu to treat their patients in Pakistan. The, you know, Cubans who famously love their pork, didn't eat pork for 3 years while working with their patients in Pakistan, learned the customs and traditions of the people to work with them. That is the remarkable side of the Cuban medical brigades. The fact that they've gone not just to, you know, places that we know that always are suffering, Haiti, Guatemala, but that they even offered to go to places like the United States. Mm-hmm. In 2005, when Hurricane Katrina happened, the Cuban doctors were with their bags ready. I remember seeing them at one of the stadiums in Havana with their bags packed with medicine and supplies to get on a plane to New Orleans. The visas never arrived. The U.S. never responded to the offer. And we know the story. Hundreds of people, thousands of people died because of lack of healthcare in New Orleans after the hurricane. So it's incredible to see that again, despite the limitations, the financial limitations that Cuba has, the medical limitations that it suffers due to shortages and scarcity, is that they continue to send. And the fact that in the middle of the pandemic, just in 2020, they sent brigades to over 43 countries around the world, including in Europe, including in the heart of the first world. Cuba sent doctors to treat the needy without asking for anything in return, at great cost to itself. That is important to say. Are these people slaves? Are they going forced? No, these are all volunteer brigades. It's an honor for a Cuban doctor to volunteer to go on a brigade. Not only because it increases their ability to actually know another culture, another country, but it's hard for the capitalists to understand the desire to help other human beings. And because they criticize it.
In the U.S., you become a doctor to make money. I mean, not everybody does. Of course, people become doctors because they want to help people. But in the U.S., one of the main incentives of becoming a doctor is the monetary compensation, despite the fact that, you know, people end up in extreme debt to go to medical school in the U.S. as well. But I mean, 43 countries, it's amazing, especially when you consider that the U.S. is, again, I just can't, every time I hear about Cuba, all I can think is the U.S. as the heart of capitalism is just the polar opposite, where it's like Cuba sending doctors abroad and wants to share its vaccine. Whereas with the U.S., it's the opposite. Countries can't get vaccines because U.S. pharmaceutical companies control the entire process and refuse to release their patents. And it really is like you put U.S. and Cuba next to each other and it's capitalism versus socialism. Of course. And you can just look at the numbers. We can sit here and talk about the moral side of it, right? But you can also just look at the numbers. You know, Cuba has managed to at times have a higher life expectancy than the U.S. And again, Cuba is a poor country that lives next to the most powerful empire in the world that is strangling it all the time. And still, because of its system, manages to have a high life expectancy, have low child mortality, to have one of the highest literacy rates, and on and on and on. But I do want to ask you, you know, one thing that I find amazing about Cuba is that it always does have to face these hardships due to what the U.S. imposes on it. So its system is constantly adapting. It's not like it's just stayed exactly the way it was since the revolution. I'm sorry?
It wouldn't survive otherwise.
Right. And so can you talk a little bit about that? Because I don't want to glorify Cuba as perfect, but it's talked about as though it's some sort of dictatorship, but it actually does have a process, a very participatory process, especially when it comes to adjusting the system and making changes, whether it's because of, you know, new sanctions or, you know, a drought or whatever the situation might be. What is that process in Cuba? What kind of political system would you characterize it as?
Well, again, it's insulting for, I think, many Cuban people when the U.S. characterizes as a place where people don't have rights or people, it's not a democratic country, doesn't have a process, because it doesn't understand the character of the Cuban people, who are very vocal constantly about their opinions, who engage in constant public debate. I mean, if you go to Cuba, I hope you go to Cuba someday, Rania, it's for you to see constantly how people debate politics, economy, the state of the country, the state of international politics constantly are being debated in public spaces with no fear, often with contrary positions. And what the Cuban Revolution has done in many ways, with its imperfections and its contradictions, is to use that energy, that democratic energy, to constantly shift the course of the nation. Cuba has been constantly changing since 1959. The political process has changed. In the initial period, you know, the process for making decisions was actually quite massive. I mean, Fidel would call a million people to the Revolution Square and they would debate. I mean, constant back and forth between Fidel and a million people about what we should do. The decision to kick to step out of the OAS was a collective decision of over a million people in the square. The decision to, you know, open relations with the People's Republic of China in 1964 was a decision made in public with millions of people in the square. But they've then learned that they needed to hone their democratic process. So the need to actually create local institutions, local spaces of people's power to generate these discussions was important. And these have been changing constantly from 1976 to the 90s to now. I mean, Cuba just stepped out of a process a few years ago where millions of people engage in a process of discussing the current constitution of Cuba. Everyone was unhappy with the current, with the previous constitution. It was missing elements. It wasn't clear enough. It didn't actually fully explain the rights of citizens to protest, for example. And millions of people came out to actually build and design a new constitution, which was approved in a mass referendum. That is Cuba. That is the process. That I don't know what you would call it. I mean, obviously it's socialism, but Cuba has built its own particular unique system of constantly referring back to the people, constantly referring back to the people. Just a few months ago, in light of all these changes around the pandemic, Cuba decided, you know, we can't no longer work with a two-currency system. We have to go back to a one-currency system because we have to essentially try to capture as much foreign currency as possible abroad, coming into the country. And we have to marshal whatever resources we have. So a whole new system was created in one currency. The government published it. Immediately, there was pushback and feedback. And no, this doesn't work. And why are these prices so high? You can't charge electricity so high. The food prices are too high. And the government had to lower the prices for everything. Not as a result of foreign pressure, foreign intervention, but as a result of the Cuban people participating in the democratic process. And that's why I ultimately trust in the Cuban people to solve all their dissatisfactions, to solve all their contradictions, to solve all their problems.
You know, I think there's a real misunderstanding or a warped understanding in the U.S. of what rights mean. I think that's probably also why, like, when we think of rights in the U.S., we actually don't extend rights to include as many things as are included in Cuba. Because what you just described to me is democratic participation in economic policy, which is something that we don't have that at all in the U.S. There is no democratic participation whatsoever in the way our economic system works. Our economic system is a certain way. It's already been decided. And, you know, the capitalist is at the mercy of capitalism, and that's the end of it. Whereas in Cuba, there's all this space for, I mean, it just sounds incredible what you just described. It's not a question, I'm just commenting on it. But I wanna broaden this conversation out a little bit to the broader region of Latin America. Because going back to the protests that provoked this entire conversation, you know, we saw these videos of maybe a few hundred people protesting in Cuba. In some cases, they weren't even videos of Cuba. I'm sure you saw as well, people were posting picture photos of Egypt with the Egyptian flag, you know, in the frame and saying it was Cuba, just, you know, which made me laugh because how dumb can you be? But people were also posting videos of mass protests in Argentina and saying it was Cuba. That to say, there were, of course, protests in Cuba. It looked like a few hundred people, not very large from what I saw. And of course, the media in the U.S. went nuts. Meanwhile, they have consistently downplayed or blatantly ignored protests against these neoliberal right-wing governments that are backed by the U.S., whether we're talking about Haiti or Colombia or Chile. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because, you know, about that double standard, because it does seem like in the last maybe 2 years, I would say, but in recent months especially, there's been a growing momentum in these countries that have these U.S.-backed neoliberal regimes of this sort of, you know, left new pink tide, if you will.
Well, I don't always like the term pink tide. It's very deceiving because the process in Latin America is extremely dynamic. We have a diversity of progressive governments, of popular-led governments that are coming back to the fore in the region, but clearly going against this neoliberal concept of how governments and economies should be run. And ultimately, more than going against the neoliberal system, it's going against the economic interests of the United States in the region. That is what's ultimately clear, and that's ultimately the battle that's taking place in Latin America. It's the interests of the United States versus the interest of the people of Latin America. And Cuba and all of that has been a cornerstone of the resistance of the Latin American people. Many people will not remember. I was very young then, but it was Fidel who called us all to fight against the free trade agreements. It was Fidel who led actively the political struggles against all the free trade agreements in Latin America. It was Fidel who woke us up from the night of neoliberal nightmares. You know, it was Cuba who constantly supported morally and physically in many other ways the reawakening of political processes in the region. So to destroy Cuba is to, in a sense, fight back against all these changes happening in Latin America. Now, for the double standards, what could we expect? Could the U.S. ever really denounce the torturers and assassins that it has trained when they go out on killing sprees in Colombia? Could the U.S. ever denounce their own military forces committing mass rapes and killings in Haiti? We shouldn't expect that. Because constantly, again, the U.S. is trying to affirm its military dominance of the region at all costs. And what we see in Colombia, what we see taking place in Haiti, is only a small snippet of what we should continue to see in the region as this battle wages out. Because the U.S. is not giving up on its dreams of controlling the region. In fact, they are even more afraid now that between Cuba, between Venezuela, Nicaragua, their alliance with countries like Iran and China and Russia is scaring the hell out of the United States. And they don't know what to do in Latin America anymore, other than engage violently with our peoples. So we will, you know, we should continue to expect that, in fact, Cuba plays a central role for maintaining what some people call the pink tide, but what I call essentially the struggles of resistance of the peoples of the continent.
It's while you were saying that, this happens like every other episode I record, if you've ever watched, where my electricity just randomly goes out. That's thank you, America, partly. But it's back. I'm one of the lucky ones. I have a generator. But no, other people aren't so lucky. I'm actually happy when this happens when I'm filming, because it's a good reminder for people that, you know, it's really hot in Beirut right now. It's very hot and humid, and most people don't have, if they do have a generator, they don't have the dollars to access diesel to fuel the generators because of the fuel shortage. I mean, it's just a complete disaster, and this is a result, you know, not directly and only because of, but partly because of U.S. sanctions on the region. But anyways, I'm glad you explained that of Cuba's central role within it all. And I'm glad that you also explained why the pink tide is a misleading term. But all that said, you know, all this, you know, I mentioned this kind of resurgent left or progressivism, which you kind of went into. But there's also a pushback, a reaction to it from the U.S. and its allies in the region. You know, in Peru right now, you have the right trying to overturn the results of an election that was in favor of a left leader. They're trying to take that away with these false claims of electoral fraud. In Brazil, you have Lula da Silva running in the election, I believe, next year and doing well in the polls. And Bolsonaro is already vowing to reject election results if there is fraud. So you know, over and over, this was the pretext used to launch a coup in Bolivia, this idea of electoral fraud with the OAS backing it. You had the CIA chief recently in Brazil meeting with Bolsonaro. We don't know the reason for that meeting, but of course people, you know, led people to speculate that this was leading a discussion about how to push back against this resurgent left across the region. And of course this is, you know, you have the ongoing campaigns against Venezuela and Nicaragua. So what do you make in light of all of this, what we saw this week with the harsh reaction towards some protests in Cuba from the U.S., what do you make of this? Do you think we're seeing the beginning, or maybe we're in the middle of a U.S. response in collaboration with its regional allies against this resurgent left? And what might that look like given historical precedent with what the U.S. has done in the past?
I would say we're in the middle of it. It has it started a long time ago. And we saw that with the fact that, you know, Dilma Rousseff's government, there was a coup, a judicial and electoral coup against the government in Brazil. That there have been increasing attacks against the left projects in Latin America. That there have been increasing attacks against left forces in the region, in government and outside of government. You know, we're in the thick of it. Hmm. We're really in the heart of a process of the U.S. fighting at all costs to retain their dominance of the region. And I foresee that only that struggle is going to continue. What I do think is that the U.S. is ultimately on the losing side of this, in part because in their mind and their analysis, they see this as a question of governments. Governments and parties that have to be attacked. But they never really count, or they never account for the reality of the people. Hmm. You cannot continue to submit people to actual hunger and desperation like they do in Colombia. You cannot constantly wage violence on the people of Haiti and expect them to just sit back. You can't continue to impose measures of austerity in Paraguay and Uruguay and expect people to sit back. You can't continue to actually take away the rights of citizens in places like Chile and Peru and expect people to just say we're happy. There's real misery that continues to grow in these countries, and the U.S. will not be able to hold that back. And they also, what the U.S. does understand is that the misery of the people of Latin America actually has an explosive revolutionary potential when countries like Cuba, Venezuela exist as examples of another possible world that isn't far away, that isn't the U.S. dream, that isn't Europe, but is actually concrete in our own region. The fact that Cuba still says, in the middle of a pandemic, healthcare and food, housing our rights, is an example to all the peoples of Latin America. So they know what they're fighting for, and they won't be giving up anytime soon. And the U.S. is going to have to come realize that fact sooner or later.
I'm curious, you know, I did think, because it was under Obama that, you know, some of the blockade on Cuba was being peeled back a little bit. So I guess I had assumed that with Biden coming to power, because he was Obama's vice president, you know, he would kind of revert back to that. I thought the same thing with the Iran nuclear deal. I thought he'd revert back to that quickly. And of course, as we've seen, he's actually only escalated against Iran and really continued Trump's policy. And the same with Cuba. So I guess my question for you is, when it comes to Latin America, is there a difference at all between these two parties?
I mean, I don't like to think that everyone is the same. I think there are definitely their particularities. Even in the ways they attack us, they are very particular, because the reality is that the Biden administration, Biden himself have, you know, painted themselves. They have dressed themselves as being progressives on the international stage. You know, they're the friends of everyone. They like to distinguish themselves from Trump. You know, they are not racist, they are progressive, they are for rights of the people, for rights of women, etc. And they created an illusion. I mean, Biden came in actually promising a complete revision of foreign policy towards Cuba and Latin America. He said he was going to engage with Cuba and Latin America on new terms, on different terms. And the reality, as we know, has been the complete opposite. But I think we have to understand why. That this is not, again, this is not a question of whim or of Biden just waking up and saying, I don't like Cuba. But that ultimately, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua continue to present real political threats to the U.S. dominance in the region, especially in light of their Cold War with China. That's ultimately what's guiding this whole process. The U.S. does not want to continue to allow any countries in Latin America to have independent relationships with China, one, and they don't want to continue allow spaces or countries in the region that serve as springboards for political transformations towards the left. That's why they also understand, and they see, you know, they're like sharks who see blood in the water right now, who say, if Cuba's weak, now is the time to weaken them even further. If the noose wasn't tight enough, let's tighten it even more. That is the politics of the United States. That's how they're approaching Cuba. That's how they're approaching Venezuela and Nicaragua. And it's important to not separate these three countries, because they are now, I see some progressives in the U.S. who will say, well, Cuba is okay. It's kind of okay. Even though they repress a little, they're okay. Venezuela, we can sort of defend them, but Nicaragua, we can defend them. No, the reality of these three countries is tied to each other. In the same way that the struggles of the people of Lebanon, of Syria, Iran, Iraq are tied to our struggles as well. We have to defend the right to a world where we don't have to live under fear of the United States government. We have to defend the world free of sanctions and blockades. And the Cuban example teaches us we have to be internationalists. We cannot separate these struggles.
Well said. And I mean, I think that's the perfect note to end on, is a very international perspective. Manolo, where can people follow your work? And where can, also, I would add to that, is there any campaigns that you, around helping Cuba that you'd like to give some attention to?
Well, the People's Forum for a while has been organizing a campaign to send syringes to Cuba, because we know that while Cuba has produced these amazing vaccines, it lacks the syringes to fully, you know, apply the vaccines in Cuba. So we're fundraising. We're continuing to fundraise on our webpage to send these syringes to Cuba. We've also engaged with different partners, and we'll be working with other partners in the U.S. to actually organize a new campaign to allow Cuba to live. Let Cuba live. Let Cuba actually have the right to exist. We're pushing for that campaign that will send material aid to the people of Cuba. And as well, check out everything that Tricontinental Institute puts out. We just put out great research on U.S. military bases in Africa, which, again, everything is interconnected. We have to keep stay up to date on all the moves that imperialism is making around the world.
Thank you so much, Manolo, for joining me.
Thank you.